The interactive portion of the show. This is where we take your phone calls with Leonard Mlodinow right here on Coast to Coast AM. Leonard, is it illegal to use subliminal messaging? I had heard it was in television commercials.
I think it was outlawed. I think it was. And did you know that George Bush's campaign tried it? And I guess in the 2000, well, his first campaign, I guess.
I bet they've all tried it.
That's the only one that I know of. They showed an ad with, it had, I think it had Gore's name and a rat on it or something like that. and they withdrew it after a while. But, you know, the thing is that I don't think that those single frame things, that they really work. But there are other ways to do it. You know, and of course, all the candidates, whenever they appear on television, they orchestrate very carefully. For instance, you know, the setting, who's behind them, who's near them. I remember, I think Obama in the last campaign, there was some, he got, well, I would say caught, whatever, if you want to say caught or whatever, at least it was noticed that they had, he had to have an audience behind him was pretty uniformly white and behind the podium, and they moved some people over to put some black people and have it more of a mixed, you know, mixed group behind them. And, you know, they're all very conscious of the, you know, subliminal messaging that just the environment they appear in, you know, reveals. And those things are, you know, really much bigger persuaders than, a single frame that you don't notice on a TV ad. You know, although I have to say there have been studies of those kinds of things, and some of them show, a little bit of an effect. But it doesn't seem to be a real strong effect like some of the others we've been talking about earlier.
What is your definition of subliminal?
Well, subliminal is below the threshold of consciousness. So that means anything that your senses take in that your conscious mind doesn't notice. So it could, it's interesting. Everything that you see is not consciously seen. You know, there's a famous video where people watching the video of a basketball game, and the subjects are told to watch the basketball game and count how many passes are made between players in the game. And in the middle of the game, a man in a gorilla suit runs across the screen. Right? And most people don't notice that man, because even though their eyes obviously took in the information, they were focused on something else, some other part. I mean, it was, you know, directly in front of them, but they were focused on counting the ball. And so you don't really consciously absorb everything that you see. You know, in fact, the most interesting result of that is that there are people who can see and don't know it. So you can have parts of your brain destroyed, say in a stroke, so where you are not consciously aware of seeing, and yet the unconscious parts of your brain are still getting the visual information from your eyes through your optic nerve. And so these people, it's called blind sight. They have this condition. They can react to things without knowing why they're reacting. So, for instance, in one experiment, they took a fellow who had this condition, and they said, walk down this hallway. And as he walked down, he'd step left. Sometimes he'd step right to avoid obstacles that the experimenters had placed in the hallway. And they asked him, why were you walking left and right? Because, you know, why are you moving like that? You're blind. You know, did you see something? He said, no, I didn't see anything. I just felt like I better do that. So, because unconscious mind was telling him, you better not go, you better move over because you're going to trip. Or you could take people again, you could throw them a ball, and some of those people can actually, they'll just respond reflectively and catch the ball without consciously seeing it. So it's pretty amazing how the mind works.
Yeah, it really is. Let's take some calls here for you. We'll go to Mike in Louisville, Kentucky on the wild card line. Hey, Michael, go ahead.
Hi, George. I'm just wondering if your guest has ever studied people who can see the subliminal images, because I don't know, about 20 years ago I was watching Oliver Stone's movie JFK, and I was watching it on VHS tape, and there was a subliminal image of a skeleton sitting in a chair illuminated with fluorescent lights. And the only thing I can think of at the time, I had a job where I had to read addresses extremely fast. And I can only imagine that maybe I was trained to see things quickly, you know, to see images quickly like that. I don't know, but I saw it as I was watching it. I saw something flash, and I said, "What was that?" And I rewound it, went forward slowly, and there it was, clear as day. It was just a skeleton. It was just like one frame. And I always wondered why I saw that. My wife at the time couldn't see it. Well, until I slowed it down and stopped, froze it. But I always wondered why I saw that, but she couldn't. Has ever studied that before?
Well, Mike, that's really fascinating. I don't think anyone has studied that, but I can see that, you know, people have different thresholds of how quick of an image they can see. And I suppose that, you know, given the training that you had to read the addresses, that probably affected you in that way, that you could, you know, I think it's a 30th, if you're watching a film, I think it's a 30th of a second.
Yeah, exactly.
And I guess you were able to, you know, to see that. It's amazing what people can do if they, you know, if you train yourself. But most people don't see that. It's interesting. I would think that if you're really that, have that much acuity, did it ever bother you when you're watching that it looks like there's flickering? Because if you can actually see the individual frames, then it's not really going enough, you know, the frame rate's not high enough for you, right?
Well, remember the kids, Leonard, in Japan who were watching a cartoon that had that flicker to it, and they convulsed?
Oh, yeah, yeah, because there was, I don't know any of the details about that, but isn't that also trigger epilepsy in some people?
Yes, it sure does.
Yeah, so it's interesting what your brain can do and sometimes does and you don't, you know, obviously want it to do.
What's driving our behavior, the conscious or subconscious mind?
Well, it's both, really. Your will is exercised, obviously, through your conscious mind, but there are these subtle effects that your unconscious is feeding into it. So you are... You know, it's really both, and, you know, in any given situation, it's hard to say which it is. I think back to the example that I talked about where people buy wine from a country where the music is, you know, where they're hearing music from that country. Obviously the unconscious is pushing them based on the music. Their conscious mind is pushing them perhaps based on their taste, and, you know, it's a battle. So not always a battle. Sometimes they both point in the same direction. But one fact is that most of your mental processes are unconscious. So if you are, let's say you're laying in bed or you're on a couch, you're being a couch potato and you're not really thinking about very much, but your unconscious is still working. It's processing your vision, it's beating your heart and everything else. And then you compare the energy usage of your brain to a situation where you're, say, concentrating very hard, playing a game of chess or something. The energy usage only goes up a couple percent. So, you know, the conscious mind is like the tip of the iceberg, and most of the brain processes are underwater. They're the iceberg.
All right, let's go to Rachel in Marina Del Rey. That's in California. Welcome to the program. Hi, Rachel. Well, she's not there. Well, let's go next to Ann in Madison, Wisconsin, east of the Rockies. Go ahead, Ann.
Yes, you mentioned in the first hour the idea that you can have something come from nothing, and it just tripped a memory of reading a book called After Finitude by a hot new French philosopher, Meyesu, whose field is a new one called speculative materialism. And he talks about the beginning of the universe, the beginning of planet Earth, and that in 300 billion years, life appeared, and he rejects the idea that there was a life principle operating right from the beginning. He's saying that from inorganic or organic matter, life couldn't come, that it came almost by chance or contingency, and I think that he's eliminating the panspermia argument from his philosophical text, maybe to keep it cleaner. But I wondered, since I heard you say that you've been in Europe, He is a hot item in Europe, although he's in his mid-40s now and probably a bit past the Wunderkind stage of as a philosopher. But I wondered if you were aware of him.
I am. I'm not extremely familiar with his philosophy, but the idea is that inorganic can create or cannot create.
In his view, there can't be some sort of, if I can use the word, subliminal life principle that was operative right from the beginning. That he said that you had integrant organic matter, and then life appeared. And it's a very intriguing point of view that he's developing. And I think it speaks to, the subtitle of After Finitude is The Essay on the Necessity of Contingency. So we're, mm-hmm. contingency being a sort of synonym for chance.
Mm-hmm. Right, that chance was necessary for things to have developed as they did.
Right. I know that in the 70s, when I took a history of science course, the theory was a sort of Frankensteinian. You had all these storms, and it was like, has it begun to storm yet, Igor? And that somehow that was zapping life into being. I think that that's probably not particularly, but I think the panspermia idea that life is everywhere in the universe could have been carried here through asteroids and things of that sort.
No, there's no doubt about that, Leonard, at all. Are you a believer in life out there, Leonard? Intelligent life?
Oh, that's an interesting question. I do believe in it. But I have to say that my belief is more of a kind of a faith-based or intuitive belief than a scientific belief, because, even though we have found that sun-like stars are not uncommon and
Earth-like planets are teeming throughout.
Yeah, and we're finding more and more Earth-like planets now, and I'm sure that will continue. But there's still one unknown, so you can't really say that science says life, is likely or not likely, because we still don't know how the first life began on Earth, or how likely or unlikely it is, given an Earth-like planet, that life will begin.
We don't even know what life is.
Well, it's very hard to define. That's right. It's even but given if you think it's like pornography, I can't define it, but I know it when I see it. So let's ignore that question for now. But we have a pretty good idea on how life developed through evolution. But the first macromolecules of life, that can be used for genetic transference and to hold, complex organic macromolecules in some kind of membrane, how that first thing formed. I mean, we know that it can be inherited and it can evolve, it can change, but how does the first one form? There's some studies, people are looking at that, but nobody really knows how that happened, and so they don't know. Either can't say how likely it is. So therefore, as a scientist, I can't really honestly say that science says that it's likely or it's unlikely. The truth is, we don't know. You can be seduced by these new, findings of stars like the sun and planets like the Earth, but that doesn't give it to you, because you still don't know if it's, it could be the chances of on an Earth-like planet could be of life forming. Could be one in a million, in which case there's probably millions of them or billions of them. But it could also be one in a trillion, in which case there's, probably none other than us. So,
well, I mean, even the mere fact, Leonard, you and I, here we are talking on this huge radio program. The whole thing is weird, isn't it? The whole thing is strange. Why you're here, why I'm here, why we do what we do. I mean, it just is bizarre.
Well, it is, especially if you're a physicist and you think of the universe in terms of the fundamental laws, to think that a bunch of atoms and electrons and protons came together without any, let's say, I don't believe that it came together based on some extra physics spirit that I have. It just these atoms and molecules came together,
and these inanimate things that are just elementary particles interacting by these forces that we have mathematics which describes them, you know, they're very, very cut and dry, that they can create, you know, a very highly organized thing like me who feels things is bizarre indeed. So I don't know how to take that, but that, you know, obviously it happens.
Let's go to Drew in Oroville, California, west of the Rockies. Hi, Drew. Go ahead.
George, hey. This is the Drew by Chico again, man. What's up?
There you go. Hi.
Hey, waving a hand again, George. You two are the guests tonight. Pretty good show. Well, George, I have to say one thing. I guess the abduction, remember we talked about that, my kneecaps and stuff. I got that all checked out. It's kind of slowed down a little bit. The abduction scenario kind of slowed down. But anyway, I got kind of interested in the topic tonight, what you guys were talking about. And I got to tell our guest something for the show tonight.
Go ahead.
Now, you know, it's amazing. How can I say this? I am a very spiritual person. I said that before. But, you know, the conscious mind is very different than the unconscious. Well, how can I say this? For your guest tonight, George, your listener, you know, I recommend some kind of spiritual help I need, okay? But I don't recommend, like, hypnosis type. The back of my subconscious in the spirit world is so interesting. It's so intriguing. It's kind of bizarre. You know, if it was like this in the conscious mind, how my unconscious is, I can't even explain it. Well, what I'm trying to say is for your guest, George, is there's parts inside of my brain that I've used and have not used, especially in dreams or not dreams, the conscious, subconscious, okay? But there's different parts of my head. If I could learn what I need, what to use to open up the type of cells that I can't use for, like, levitation, you know what I mean? I don't know if you guys believe in that.
I don't believe in levitation.
No, not at all. But we do believe in the power of the unconscious mind. Or do you call it unconscious or subconscious?
Well, it's kind of interchangeable. So I know, I mean, some people may make distinctions, but usually in the research today, it's called either one interchangeably, or some people even call it the non-conscious, just to get away from, you know, the old meanings of subconscious and unconscious.
What percentage, if you could categorize between the two, are people using back and forth, the subconscious and the conscious?
Well, you mean what percentage of your capacity are you using, or what percentage mind is conscious versus unconscious?
Yeah, exactly.
I think it's about, you know, about 5% of your processes are even fewer than 3% are conscious, and all the rest is unconscious.
Really? That's huge. What a difference.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, and there's a lot that your brain has to do that you don't even think about, like, you know, beating your heart, breathing, keeping your balance, you know, processing. A large part of your brain is there for visual processing to help you decipher what you see. All your motor abilities, you know, we don't think about all these things because we can move, we can walk, we can balance ourselves, but, you know, you're not doing that consciously. Your unconscious mind is doing all that for you.
How come sometimes when somebody has an injury to the brain, it either tunes them up or it makes them worse?
Well, I would guess that the tuning you up is you know, an anomaly. That I would not, you know, hit my head in the hopes that I'm going to get better. You know, it generally,
no, either would I.
Yeah, it generally will make you worse, because you're made to work in a certain way, and having some random change that is caused by an injury is not probably going to help.
Leonard, we're going to come back and take final phone calls with you in just a moment, right here on Coast to Coast AM. On our next Coast to Coast program, Richard Martini joins me as we talk about his work with afterlife and reincarnation. He'll also talk a little bit about the life of Amelia Earhart on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back with Leonard Mlodinow. Leonard, what is brain imaging?
Well, brain imaging is taking pictures of the brain, you know, through your skull, but more important than that, it's not just taking pictures of the structure of your brain, it's showing what part of your brain is active at a certain time. So the main technique these days is called functional magnetic resonance imaging, or fMRI. That's something like the MRI your doctor uses to look at your organs, but the F for functional is there because it there's an added element to it where not only using this technique, not only do you see a 3D picture of the physical brain, but you can see in color different parts as that are working at any given time. So if something particular part of your brain is particularly active, then you can see where that is. So it lets scientists connect human behavior, human thoughts or perceptions to the parts of the brain where those are located.
All right, back to the phones we go. Corey in Fort Wayne, Indiana on the wildcard line. Welcome to the program. Hi, Corey.
Hello. Thank you, George. Great show as always.
Thank you, sir.
Leonard, how much of Bandler and Grinder's work on NLP did you, when researching for your, and what do you think of the guy?
What did I think of what?
You broke up right at the end there, Corey. You still there? No, we lost him.
Okay, did you catch?
No, he was gone right at the end. Oh, well. We tried. Let's go to Rachel in Burbank. Wild card line. Go ahead, Rachel.
Firstly, I read your book. It was a lot of fun. It was a fun read.
Thank you.
And, a lot of insightful information that I've incorporated into my life. So the reason I'm calling is because I am an entrepreneur and I'm trying to get capital from Silicon Valley, which is predominantly no women. So I wanted to know if there's any techniques I could use to subconsciously manipulate someone in, let's say, a PowerPoint presentation.
Wow, that's an interesting question.
Because I already know, like, I'm a female. They look at my name. There's so many subconscious things that I'm automatically.
There are, and as a female, you have to be careful, too, because certain qualities that men like to see in a man that are actually useful if you're leading a company, they don't like to see in women, right?
I know. Mm-hmm. Yes.
And so, you have to be careful with that. I mean, one thing you could do is, are you the sole proprietor, or are there others involved with you?
No. And there aren't. And I've had a lot of, I mean, I'm not going to get into all the details, but let's just say I had no idea how much my gender would factor in.
I know. And sadly, even with men who believe consciously that they're against that, that they want to be fair, they also have a hard time following through with that because we have these unconscious built-in biases. I would just say you have to, work twice as hard to look professional, to dress professionally, and, to know your stuff. I wish I had a magic, a magic tool. There are certain qualities of your face that will affect how that's perceived. I think I mentioned some of that in the book. Like a woman with a slight widow's peak are looked at as being more competent, slight almond-shaped eyes, which I think you can manipulate with makeup. So, I mean, there are certain aspects of your appearance, I think, that you might be able to manipulate. And I know that the way you speak, for instance, is very important, and you seem to come across, at least in this call, as being authoritative, and that's working well. But so I don't know. I don't really have a magic bullet. I'm sorry to say. Unfortunately, my suggestion was going to be, bring a man with you and at least trade off. But it's sad. I just think it's sad. I don't know if you were listening earlier when we talked about the study of the physics lectures where the.
I read your book, so yeah.
Yeah. So it's very hard, and it's a bad thing, but you just have to. I just have to work harder to make, doubly good impression.
Yeah, which I absolutely understand and I've kind of accepted, but I'm at this point where I have this one opening to send a PowerPoint presentation to someone's daughter who's pretty, he's like a rock star in Silicon Valley. Mm-hmm. So I've been putting together this PowerPoint. I didn't know if I wanted my a male to narrate it? Would that, like...
Oh, so it's a power... We're not giving it in person. It's a PowerPoint.
No, well, in person, I'm a lot more... In person, I can dress the part and manipulate the hair, makeup, and a lot of other things. Mm-hmm. But...
So this is something that they're not going to, it's going to be narrated. Yeah, I hate to say this, but I would choose a nice, authoritative, deep sounding man's voice. Yeah.
Well, sometimes Leonard, a woman in business, strangely could be so authoritative to a man that he panics.
That can happen too. That's right. As I said, there are some things that you admire in a man, men admire in a man, but are afraid of in a woman.
It's a fine line.
Yeah, it's tough. And I have sympathy for you because it's too bad that's the case.
You know, I'm going to cite a subliminal story that happened a long, long time ago. And an ex-football player was in sales, and the guy was about 6'5". And he would call, and he had a very successful track record in selling. He was a nice guy, except he could never, ever make a sale to a company, which was a huge company, because the buyer somehow didn't like him. The guy was about 5'2", and, just the guy's mere presence intimidated him. And he just didn't know what to do because he was a good guy, great product. He just couldn't get this guy to buy anything with him. And one day he was talking to someone, and the guy says, listen, you've now explained something, and I'm going to tell you the psyche. You've intimidated the guy. You have made him feel subservient to you. This is what you do. And so he told him what to do. So the guy gets another appointment to come see him, and, they always let him in as a courtesy. He comes in the door of the guy's office, who's sitting behind his desk, small guy, and the 6'5" ex-football player with his briefcase, and he's holding it, but it's open, but he's holding it closed, so it looks like it's closed. He trips on purpose and falls. Okay, he goes flying. The briefcase goes scattering, papers go flying. He's on his face. The 5'2" little guy gets up and goes rushing over to help him up. So he's propping up the 6'5" guy. He's on his knees putting the guy's papers in his briefcase, helping him, dusting him off. And the guy sits down in his chair in front of the office, in front of his desk. And you know what? He got the sale.
Yeah, that's a great story. And that's a well-known effect, too, that you have sympathy for people who, who make do a pratfall like that. And in this case, sure, it made him, it put them more on equal ground. Because,
yeah, put him at ease.
Yeah, it put him at ease. And that's a great story. So so Rachel, I don't know, go, trip as you walk.
Yeah. Would you call that subliminal?
Well, the subliminal part of it is that, yeah, it's subliminal in the sense that the guy who was affected by this probably would not realize that's what it did it, right? So it affects him in an unconscious manner. It affected the way he thought about this other football player without his realizing it, right? I'm imagining that if you had asked him, if he had been honest, he would have denied that fall. He gave him the account or bought the goods because the guy fell, right? That would sound silly.
Sure would. Okay, let's go next. We go to Stockbridge, Wisconsin. First-time caller Kevin's with us. Hey, Kevin, go ahead.
Good morning, Mr. Barry. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
A couple of years ago, my wife and I, we heard a song on the radio, and I'm really good with songs. And for the life of me, I couldn't think of it, and I was frustrated. I thought about it for a half an hour and couldn't think of the song. Couple days passed, and I literally woke up at like 3 a.m. and she's like, what's the matter? And I'm like, the name of the song was whatever it was. And she's like, what? And I was like, yeah. And I was just kind of wondering what was going on there. I mean, was I subconsciously filing through my memories and finally came to the song, and it just woke me at that time in the morning, or what?
that's pretty much what happened. And that's why, you know, we talked earlier about how if you have a very difficult, you know, problem, a mental problem that you're trying to solve, like a physics problem or a business problem, or you're trying to remember something, that, you know, sometimes it's good to try really hard to figure it out and then to take a break. And while you, if you try really hard and then you take a break, your subconscious will continue working on it while your conscious is off doing other things. And, you know, 3 days that, you know, you're a persistent, you have a persistent subconscious, but it found it and it said, hey, there it is, Kevin.
But yeah, wake me up at 3 a.m, you know.
That's interesting. Was it important to you somehow to know the name? Did you feel consciously that at least that it was important or?
I mean, I've always been like really good with, you know, names of songs and, or, you know, who sang them or whatever, but, you know, but like I said, you know, I wasn't even consciously thinking about it. Like after that first half an hour, I got frustrated and pretty much just blew it off.
You thought you blew it off.
Yeah, so, I thought I did.
Yeah.
You know, see? 3 days later, you know, to my surprise, I'm waking myself up at 3 a.m. and being like, oh, hey, by the way, this is the name of the song. Like it just came to me.
Yeah, well, that's a great story. You see, it just shows that your brain is working hard even when you're resting.
Take a few more calls here. We go to Dolores in Boston. Let's go east. Hey, Dolores, thanks. Go ahead.
Hey, gentlemen, if I may say this, I know this may be a little aside, but you keep speaking about God, and I just want to say, do study him. St. Thomas Aquinas is great. I can teach 4-year-olds. The distinction between living, non-living, singly, doubly, trebly, and automotive souls, eternity, and they comprehend it. Do your homework. There is a God. Yes, you can prove it scientifically, might I add. And that was all I wanted to say. I appreciate the fact that there's a question. And shame on the Vatican for attacking you because of the media. They should have done their homework.
Yeah. Yeah, I wondered, did they ever read the book? I guess not before they attacked us, but anyway, thank you.
Yeah, what has been the reaction to subliminal?
To subliminal, people are just, you know, some people have a hard time accepting that they're not totally in charge. I mean, that's, I think, a natural reaction. But, you know, for the most part, people are, I think, as Rachel said, it makes them think differently about their, you know, about how they're living. And I think it's changing people's lives. And it's just the beginning, you know, the stuff I wrote about and the stuff that scientists know now. It's, this field is only, you know, 10, 15 years old, and there's going to be a lot more coming.
I think so. Joe is in Pensacola. Hey, Joe, go ahead.
Hey, good to talk to you guys. How
good,
you doing?
Good to have you with us too, Joe. Go ahead.
I was just going to ask Leonard, what does he think about predictive programming? It's something in movies and in media or any other corporate-controlled, mass-consumed information that can be manipulated by the owners of that. And it's consumed by the masses and could actually affect the collective subconscious. How easy is that to do?
Well, see, you only talked about, you know, a collective unconscious, but there really isn't a lot of evidence of, you know, that there is a collective unconscious. And of course, there are shared cultural things that affect our unconscious, like in, you know, that affect, for instance, people's biases. But I think this protective programming is a conspiracy theory kind of thing, and I don't really see that it's, you know, that it's even possible because, you know, knowing the events in advance is just not, you know, people can't really see the future. So I don't see it having a lot of validity.
Last caller here, Canton, Ohio, we go. Phil. Go ahead, Phil.
Hey, thanks, George. How are you doing?
Good, good.
Okay. Hey, Leonard, I have a question for you. I've been pushed around a lot as a kid, beat up a lot, and I never fought back. But yet sometimes I have these dreams that I'm like something out of a movie character, or like out of a movie, like a character or a comic book hero. to defend myself in my dreams. I guess what I'm asking is there any way, you know, people can teach others how to defend their subconscious, or how the subconscious can defend itself?
How the subconscious can defend itself against, you mean against these being pushed around?
Yeah, well, like people chasing me in my dreams with bats or lead pipes or something, a way to fight back.
So is that, you are having dreams like that now?
Well, not now, but when I was younger, in my teen years, going in my 20s.
So when you were younger, I thought, okay, so you were pushed around in real life, or you dreamt a lot about being pushed around?
No, I was pushed around a lot in real life. I never, like, stood up for myself.
And is that still happening these days?
Sometimes it does, because I'm not the type of person to be, you know, putting my hands on people in a physical matter or any matter. I usually just let it go. But sometimes if I'm upset about something, and sometimes my conscious will think about those things, you know, as I'm sitting around doing nothing, or if I'm asleep, you know, and I usually have these dreams sometimes.
Well, you know what? Rosemary Ellen Guiley would simply say, in your dream state, if it's a lucid dream and you know you're dreaming, you can literally change the outcome, which will affect you in your real life. Leonard, thank you so much for being on the program. Subliminal, that's his latest work. For Dan Galante, Nathan Staten, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Lottasour, Stephanie Smith, Chris Burrows, George Knapp, John B. Wells, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell. I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.